This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us today, a beautiful June day across the state of North Dakota, where we might reflect on our state's rich history, some of it which predates us even arriving here, that is, the white European settlers that dominate the state now. We're going to talk about that with Clay Jenkinson. Clay is a Lewis and Clark scholar. He's editor of the quarterly We Proceeded On. And, of course, he's well known on public radio as the voice of Thomas Jefferson on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. He joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us, Clay.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I was just introduced to this title. I wasn't aware of this quarterly, We Proceeded On, this magazine that you edit now. It's been published for more than 40 years, I discover. What's its editorial mission?
Its mission is to discover new things about the Lewis and Clark story and to examine things we thought we knew about the characters of Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea and so on and so forth. And I was asked, I think, a year and a half ago to edit the journal. It's a quarterly, and people can find it by going to the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation website in Great Falls. But it comes out four times a year. It's a scholarly journal, but it's written for the general public. And it's just a delight for me. I've been kind of away from the Lewis and Clark story for a number of years, and now I'm jumping way back in, and it's just been really extraordinary to realize how rich this story is. And as I always have said, Doug, they spent more time in the state of North Dakota than any other place. And North Dakota was the center of the expedition. They wintered here. Their most successful relations with Native peoples were here with the Mandan. This was a very, very important part of this story, and all North Dakotans, all people of this region have reason to be proud.
LewisandClark.org is one way you can find this information, and I did go up there, Clay, and I pulled down the very first newsletter, the first quarterly newsletter I could find from this organization, which was the winter of 1974, and
wow.
North Dakota was all over it. So it's, as you suggest, this is an important story for the state. Let's talk about the title of this journal, though. We Proceeded On. What significance does that have?
Clark was the best journal keeper of the bunch. Lewis actually went silent for long periods, and nobody really knows what that means. He was sort of violating his promise to Mr. Jefferson, the president, that he would keep a rich daily journal. But Clark was very reliable as a record keeper, and he frequently says, Doug, well, the boat sprang a leak, and we stopped because we had a court-martial, or we stopped because we saw some buffalo that we wanted to kill. And then he says, we proceeded on. That tagline occurs scores of times, probably hundreds of times in the journals. I don't know if Clark was aware that this was something he repeated as often as he did, but it's such a great idea that whatever else is true, this motley group of about 33 kept moving forward, and that's the only way you get to the Pacific.
And now the Heritage Foundation proceeds on.
Okay. Indeed.
I saw a Facebook post by you some time back which had a photograph in it that shows you with a fellow by the name of Kevin O'Brien. And I discover he's a Montana-based archaeologist and ethnohistorian, and he likes to lead tours around Lewis and Clark country. He showed you something last summer. Describe what you saw and why that inspired this special edition, of this special issue of the We Proceeded On Quarterly.
Every summer, I lead a group of cultural tourists on the Lewis and Clark Trail in Montana and Idaho. We spend 3 days on the White Cliffs section, the most beautiful section of the Missouri River, canoeing. Then we clean up, and then we spend 3 more days up on the Lolo Trail west of Missoula, which is the old Nez Perce Trail that Lewis and Clark followed to get through the Rocky or Bitterroot Mountains. It's the greatest cultural journey I get to take every year. It's the time when I really relax and kind of regroup, and it's a journey that changes people's lives. So I've done it, I think, 16 or 17 years in a row. I'll be doing it this summer. And about 30 people come, 25 to 30 people from all over the world. So last summer I'm out there with this young man that I really like, Kevin O'Brien. And he says, Clay, I think I want to show you something. So we go down by the river and he unfolds this map. And first when you look at it, Doug, it's sort of hard to figure out what it is. And then he started to tell me, well, this is a map that was drawn by an Arikara man that Lewis and Clark met and traveled with. And the Arikara man by the name of Tuni, or Arkit Arnarshar, eventually went to Washington, D.C. to meet the great father, Thomas Jefferson. Unfortunately, this Arikara leader died in Washington, D.C., and Jefferson wrote a famous letter of condolence to the Arikara. But unbeknownst to any of us, this man, Tooney, or Arkita Narshar, drew a map while he was in St. Louis or Washington. It's a map of the Arikara world around the time of Lewis and Clark. In fact, Lewis and Clark are on his map. It's a fabulous piece of work, and somehow it slipped out of people's understanding, and it went to France. It's been sitting in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France for the past 200 and some years, and a scholar doing graduate work on Native American cartography discovered it, published an article in William and Mary Quarterly in 2014, and this archaeologist friend of mine, Kevin O'Brien, read that article and got a copy of the map and fell in love with it. And when he showed me, I said, wow. You know, Harry Fritz of the University of Montana, one of the leading historians of our sister state, said everything to be known about Lewis and Clark is known. There's nothing left to know. He couldn't have been more wrong. I mean, this map has been sitting in this archive. It's now been discovered. For North Dakota, this is a major, major event. This is a map from the Grand River on the North Dakota-South Dakota border to the Knife River villages, the five Mandan and Hidatsa Earth Lodge villages. But it extends all the way at one end to Santa Fe and at the other end to the Fort Assiniboine and up in today's Winnipeg. It has the Missouri and the Yellowstone. It has the Lakota people. It has the Cheyenne people. It has the Crow. It's an absolutely extraordinary map, and that's just the geopolitical side of it. There are also sacred sites that are important to the Arikara. And one of my goals, Doug, is to get Arikara elders to study this map with me and explain it to me, because these sacred sites are probably forgotten in all the chaos that has occurred since the encounter of Europeans with native peoples. And I believe there will be a rich oral tradition that will help us understand the Arikara world at the time of contact. And that would be a tremendous cultural benefit to the Arikara people, to the people of North Dakota, and all those who love Lewis and Clark.
Well, you mention in the essays associated with this presentation in We Proceeded On Quarterly, one of those sites, a particular rock, which is Medicine Rock State Historic Site near Elgin. You made a pilgrimage there earlier this year.
I did.
And it's still being used.
It's still there. It's a state historic site. It's in the middle of a ranch field. You have to actually travel a little bit through private property, but you're allowed to. And there up on this bluff is this sandstone outcropping. And it's sacred to a number of native peoples, to the Mandan, the Lakota, the Hidatsa, the Arikara. And when Lewis and Clark went by it, they didn't see it. When they went by it, this man, Arkita Narshar, said that over there about a day is this medicine rock. And if you go there, it's like the Oracle at Delphi. You ask the question you want to ask and fast and dance and pray. And then the next morning, the rock reveals your destiny or reveals something important for you to think about. And so Lewis and Clark mentioned this, but don't visit it. They mentioned it twice, actually. And then Maximilian, the German prince, mentions it and doesn't visit it. I've been there four or five times, Doug, and here's what's so amazing about it. I mean, almost no North Dakotans, including Native peoples, know about this. You go there, and it's not an interpretive center. It's just this outcropping with a little protective chain-link fence around it. But always when I go there, there are medicine bundles. There are tobacco medicine bundles tied by native peoples in strings that are placed there. So this is a pilgrimage site. In the year 2018, native peoples come from all over North America to visit this place, and yet you and I have lived our lives really without any knowledge of this.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this Arikara leader, Tooney. Who was he? What made him sort of special to the Arikara people to send him along with Lewis and Clark?
Good question. So Lewis and Clark arrive at the Grand River villages, and they're a little bit freaked out by it because there's been a smallpox epidemic. And so the villages, some of them are abandoned, and they don't quite know what happened. It's kind of this apocalyptic moment. And then they wind up on this island, Ashley Island, and they meet the Arikara, and they begin to do their usual diplomatic exchange and so on. And one of the individuals who comes forward is this Tooney, or Arkit Arnarshar. No one is quite sure what to call him. And Lewis and Clark give him a peace medal and the usual smoking ceremonies and so on. And then he says, well, we Arikara would like to reconcile with the Mandan. We've been sort of war skirmishing with them for the past couple of years. I'd go along with you up to the Mandan if you take me, and maybe I can fulfill your mission, which is to create intertribal peace. And so he comes along with Lewis and Clark, and he travels from October 13th, 1804, with Lewis and Clark until November 2nd, and then he's at Fort Mandan for a couple of weeks before he goes back to the Grand River villages. And here's the interesting part of this. At one point, Clark says, oh, the Indian leader who's with us pointed out a bunch of stuff, sacred sites and historic sites and ruins, and I didn't think any of this was worth writing down. And so that's sort of been used as one of the marks against Clark. But then when I found this map, I looked at the journals day by day for that period, and it turns out Clark was listening. And the things that are on this map, he does mention in the journals, and much of the information that Clark writes down during that 3-week period could only have come from this Arikara gentleman. And so what Clark says about not being really curious about it is not at all true. And so this enriches the journals, and the journals enrich the map. And now we've published the map. And the map, I think, is going to be an important cultural document because, you know, we have European maps, of course. Most of the native maps that were created during the expedition were written on the soil, little mounds of ground to show mountains, and sticks would draw rivers and tributaries, and so those maps have disappeared. This is a map that still exists and has been very carefully conserved in Paris and now can be published to the world for the first time. So it has significance because it survived.
Clay Jenkinson is a North Dakota Humanities Scholar. He is a editor also of the quarterly We Proceeded On, which will have this map in. The current issue has a pullout, a centerfold of this map. Clay, I'm always intrigued by the meeting of very different cultures in a very different place, and that is Lewis and Clark, you know, meeting Tooney and the Arikara and the Mandan and all that. Did Tooney speak English or French? How did they communicate?
That's a great question. So when they got to these tribes, the Lakota and the Yankton and the Omaha and the Oto and the Mandan and Hidatsa, they met white people or mixed blood people who were already living with those tribes. And they would not have been able to communicate with them had it not been for these traders, the most famous of which is Toussaint Charbonneau, the husband of Sacagawea. But when they got to the Arikara villages, they met a white man by the name of Joseph Gravelines, a French-Canadian. And he had lived with the Arikara for a number of years and was fluent in their language. And so they immediately hired him to be an interpreter. And then when they went on this journey from the Grand River to the Knife River, they brought not only Tooney along with them, but Joseph Gravelines to serve as the intermediary. So the Arikara leader, Tooney, would have said, now that rock over there is very important. He would have said that in Arikara, and Joseph Gravelines would have translated it from Arikara into French. And then a man named Francois Labiche, who was one of Lewis and Clark's water men, would have translated from French into English. And so imagine this. Lewis and Clark would say, well, what's the significance of it? And that would go from English to French to Arikara and back and forth and back and forth. And so it's amazing that we have as much data as we do. Gravelines then went on to travel with Tooney to Washington, D.C. And after Tooney died in the Capitol, Jefferson wrote this famous letter of condolence and then sent Gravelines back up, all the way back up to the Arikara villages to deliver the letter. And when he got there and explained that their man had gone to Washington and was not coming back, the Arikara were rightly bewildered and frustrated and even angry. And most historians believe this led to a long period, like a 25-year period of tension between Americans from St. Louis and the Arikara.
Well, we'll leave it for there for just a moment. We're talking with Clay Jenkinson, Lewis and Clark scholar and editor of the quarterly We Proceeded On, about a newly discovered map from over 200 years ago. We'll be back with Clay in just a moment.
Next time on Studio 360.
Every generation has the fears that are in Fahrenheit 451.
The sci-fi masterpiece that was a response to McCarthyism.
How do we continue to be people who care about books and care about life and care about the truth.
Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, our latest installment of American Icons, next time on Studio 360.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by Clay Jenkinson, Lewis and Clark scholar. He joins us from our microphone in our studio in Bismarck. Clay, how was this particular map, this Toonee map that was created for the Lewis and Clark expedition, how was it actually drawn out and created? What was its original form?
It was drawn on paper, and the paper was pasted together. This is how Lewis and Clark created their own maps out here. And so he must have gotten a hold of some paper either in St. Louis or somewhere. And then he drew this, and Gravelines served as the intermediary. And Gravelines actually put in French legends for the five Mandan villages that we have at Knife River. There's actually an image of the keel boat and stick figures of Lewis and Clark on it. And then Gravelines wrote the French translations for the Fort Assiniboine and up near Winnipeg and Santa Fe and the Rocky Mountains and so on and so forth. So Toonee did it. He drew it. And then Gravelines wrote in the data in French. Somehow, Doug, this map gets into the hands of Thomas Jefferson's chef, a man named Honoré Julien.
That's a great story in itself.
I mean, this makes no sense to me. So Jefferson would have regarded this as a sacred map. How it got out of his hands, nobody knows. But on the cartouche is the sort of the legend about the map that occurs in most maps of that period. And it says that Gravelines helped Toonee do this, and now it's in the hands of Honoré Julien. And so I'm a Jefferson scholar, so when I saw that, I knew that this was Jefferson's chef. And I looked it up, and I thought, what? How can this be that a chef has this map and it's not written to Thomas Jefferson? That's a mystery. And I was just talking with Monticello this morning, Doug, and they said, what? I mean, they know about Honoré Julien. He went on to be a famous Washington, D.C. French chef, and he was actually the chef all the way through the Polk administration. But why he would get this and not Jefferson or somebody else in the administration, nobody knows. That's one of the mysteries I hope that will get solved here.
Well, that's one of the questions you pose in the story, and I want to get to those, as a matter of fact. But it occurs to me that, you know, you've mentioned Sacagawea, and we're talking about Toonee and this very important discovery of this map. Weren't there other maps provided by Native Americans during the Lewis and Clark expedition?
Yes, and so I made a list of them at the back of this. First of all, when I discovered this, you know, it's not my discovery. I just happened to be told about it by this great young man, Kevin O'Brien, but I immediately realized its importance. And I wrote to the great Lewis and Clark scholars, David Nicandry and John Logan Allen, and said, do you know about this? And they said, never heard of it. And I thought, wow, we have got to dedicate a whole issue to this. So then I called the president of the foundation and said, I'm going to need 40 pages rather than the usual 32. And she gulped. And then I said, and by the way, I want to do the first ever centerfold. And she said, what? What is this, Lewis and Clark Playboy?
Yes.
A centerfold? And I said, no, we have to. The map deserves it. So we found the money and we did it. And so then I sent it to these great scholars and they looked at it. And Herman Viola, who Library of Congress, said, this is a monumental map. John Logan Allen, the great Lewis and Clark cartographer, now in Laramie, retired in Laramie, Wyoming, said, this is unbelievable. And so I dedicated the whole issue to it. And I wrote an essay, but Kevin O'Brien wrote a tremendous article about Native American maps. So at the end, to get back to your question, I thought, how many other maps were there that Lewis and Clark saw? How many mentions are there in the journals? And I went through and I found 10. And I then wrote a list of all of them and where you can find them in journals. Most of them were written on the ground or on snow or were ephemeral in one form or another. A few of them got transcribed onto paper and are in Gary Moulton's 13-volume edition of Lewis and Clark, but the whole list of them is there, a Nez Perce map, a map of the Columbia River, a map of the Willamette River, etc. But you have to say the map of maps is this one that's been languishing in some file in Paris all this time.
Well, maps, when we look at them, we have a sense of place and time, distance, that kind of thing. How do Native American maps represent distance?
Yeah, I urge everyone who's interested to subscribe to the journal. They can just go to the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation website and they can see for themselves. And Kevin's article is really important. And here's basically what he says, Doug, that our idea of north, south, east, west, and a kind of a proportionality, so the distance between Bismarck and Fargo is the same distance between Bismarck and Glendive, that sort of thing, that's not how Native American maps work. They're much more impressionistic. They don't include mileage and the kind of linearity that people like Jefferson and the Enlightenment love so much. It's much more impressionistic, the number of sleeps. Or here's another example. If the river is easy to float, they make that a small distance. But if the river has riffles and rapids and falls, they make that a long distance because they're giving you the sense of how long it's going to take you to go that part of the journey. And so most Euro-Americans, most Anglos like us, are perplexed by this. But Kevin has shown how you quote-unquote read a map like this. And once you get it, you begin to see your eyes sort of flip into focus and you see how a Native American map works. And then, of course, Kevin also notes that many of these sacred places would never be on a state map of North Dakota, but the sacred was central to Native American culture in a way that it really isn't to us. And so Toonie made sure that all of the most sacred places are there. And I want to find out where they are. For example, he mentions a lake where 50-some guys drowned that time. That's a sacred place. I don't know what lake that might be. He also talks about an underground cavern. That might be the medicine hole out in the Kildare Mountains. But really, we now need the Arikara to come forward and help us understand this.
So these maps would have some folkloric elements to them, like the sacred lake you just referred to, and this very kind of practical way of looking at distance. How long does it take to walk there, or how many nights' sleep do I have to get there?
Well, we all know this is true. Like if you drive from Beach to Fargo, some segments of it go faster than others, even if you're going 70 miles an hour every minute. We all know that time is impressionistic. And for Anglos, for people of the Enlightenment like us, we're obsessed with these conventions and this linearity and protocols. Native peoples were much more fluid and said, well, you know, the part between Beach and Medora is a lot more interesting than the part between Valley City and Jamestown. So we'll mark that differently on the map. And when an Anglo like myself looks at this, I think, come on. I mean, that's not how we do maps. But, of course, that's how they would look on us and say, in what sense are your maps useful if you don't put sacred places on them?
And that, of course, makes these even more important historically.
Of course. Yeah, it's just really amazing, and it's been such a learning experience for me. And Kevin came at this as an archaeologist who's fascinated by Native American cartography. And all I knew about maps, it comes from the European Mercator traditions. And so I'm having to break the paradigm of my training to see in a new way. And when your eyes suddenly focus, it's kind of a miraculous thing. I just hope everyone will have a chance. You can see this online, the map.
Clay Jenkinson is a Lewis and Clark scholar and editor of the quarterly We Proceeded On. We're talking about a newly discovered 200-year-old, rediscovered 200-year-old map. And we'll talk more about the Native American, the Arikara Native, who put this map together. That is Toonie. We'll find out what he did in Washington, D.C., because he lived there for a while before he passed away. We'll talk with Clay about that after the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. 17 Bismarck area companies brought 120 employees to the Burley County Extension Services building today. They were there for the first Great Plains Food Bank Bismarck Mandan Packathon. The volunteers were there to pack 1,800 boxes with meals that will be given to hungry senior citizens in Bismarck, Mandan, and Minot.
There's a huge need.
Marcia Paulson is with the Great Plains Food Bank.
We are seeing the challenges around senior hunger in our state continue to rise. Last year, 12% of those we served through the Great Plains Food Bank and our partner network were seniors. That is on the rise. And oftentimes, this is a group of people who don't ask for what they deserve. And so there's this prairie pride that gets in the way sometimes. And so this is a program that gets food right into their hands. It's a pretty easy distribution. Once they're all packed, a senior drives up with their caregiver. We put the food right in the trunk of the car, and off they go.
Jennifer Holland coordinated 8 volunteers from Basin Electric Power Cooperative.
We are proud to do some teamwork together and get out of the office on a nice day and pack some bags for those in our community.
Holland says she sees the need.
It seems like the need is getting greater and greater all the time, so when we can step up and help out, we want to.
They're calling it a victory garden. Residents at the North Dakota State Penitentiary are planting a vegetable garden on the penitentiary grounds. Joe Chervat is the chief of security at the penitentiary.
We received a grant from the Consensus Council to build and operate a victory garden, or what we're calling the victory garden, within the secure perimeter of the North Dakota State Penitentiary. So that way we can provide the labor and the space to run a garden that will provide produce and items to donate to local charities.
Chervat says the inmates will be doing much of the garden work.
It gives these guys that live here a sense of self-worth, that they're actually doing something, they're giving back to the community.
The produce will be donated to local groups such as Ministry on the Margins, the Ruth Myers Hospitality House, and the Great Plains Food Bank. And a Lutheran church that's been part of the Northwood area for more than 100 years will close its doors on Sunday. West Union Church, 9 miles outside of Northwood, will hold its last service at 2 p.m. Church Council President Echo Butt says a big reason is dwindling membership.
We're down to like 13 members is all we have now. And that's not enough to keep the church going. We're only open on every other Sunday. And just in the summer months, we only had 11 services last year.
The Norwegian-style church was established in 1885. The cornerstone on the current church was laid in 1896. But says it's sad to see the church go.
To see any church close, that is very, it's not nothing you're proud of or anything. We would wish that we had more people to come out, but Northwood has other churches, and a lot of them don't want to drive way out there on a dirt road to go to church.
But says the church is for sale, and there is one interested party. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm talking with Clay Jenkinson, a Lewis and Clark scholar and editor of the quarterly We Proceeded On. Of course, he's Thomas Jefferson in the Jefferson Hour that's heard on public radio stations across the country and, of course, on Prairie Public. We're talking about a map that was discovered in a French library in an archive. And Clay, the fellow who drew the map was an Arikara leader by the name of Tooney, who ends up in Washington. How did he get there?
Jefferson wanted to meet Native leaders, and he, in his famous instructions to Lewis, said, if you can talk leaders from the nations you meet into coming to Washington, D.C., I would love to meet them and explain to them our purposes and the benevolence of the American Republican Constitution and so on. And so Lewis and Clark dutifully attempt to get as many emissaries as they can. One of the most famous was Sheheke, the big white from the Mandan world. And getting him back to the Mandan villages proved to be an exceedingly difficult thing for Jefferson and Meriwether Lewis. But this man, Tooney, went to Washington. He went with Joseph Gravelines and a man from St. Louis named Pierre Chouteau. He met Jefferson, and one of the things I discovered in doing this was that there was a theater man, a dramatist and a painter by the name of William Dunlap, and he met Tooney in a boarding house in Washington, and he wrote this fabulous description of him. It's much better than anything in Lewis and Clark. Lewis and Clark sort of took Tooney for granted, but nobody in Washington did. James Wilkinson thought he was amazing. Jefferson thought he was amazing. Wilkinson said he knew 11 languages, and this William Dunlap wrote this very fine description, which I've reproduced in this issue of We Proceeded On. And then there's a young woman artist that I know in Animoose by the name of Katrina Case. And I sent her that description and said, would you draw a kind of courtroom sketch of what Tooney must have looked like sitting on a mattress in a boarding house in Washington, D.C.? And that's on page 23, really extraordinary piece of art of this issue. So we know a lot about him, but it had never been knitted together before, Doug. So the map had disappeared. No one had ever connected this with Honoré Julien, Jefferson's chef. Dunlap's story was known by a handful of scholars, but not by the Lewis and Clark world. And so I brought all of these elements together in this 40-page issue of it. And I think I'll say this much about it. I think that this is so important for North Dakota because, you know, we have the Mandan, the Hidatsa, and the Arikara, and we know a fair amount more about the Mandan and the Hidatsa than we do about the Arikara. And that part of the trail from the Grand River villages down past Fort Yates all the way up to Stanton or Washburn is not very well known, in part because of Lake Oahe. And so this really brings North Dakota back to the very center of this American epic, and I hope that Sarah Ottey Coleman and others will take advantage of this for North Dakota tourism, because one of the things I want to do, maybe you'll come out and do it with me, is take a pontoon and go from Mobridge all the way to Fort Mandan and take photographs of these places that Tooney was describing and mapping for William Clark.
I'll just set the date.
Here we go.
In your introduction to the Tooney map May issue, you posed some questions, and I realize they're somewhat unanswered, but let's share them here. How did the map end up in a French archive and only come to light 200 years after the fact?
Nobody knows. We have some clues that there were French diplomats who visited Monticello and may have carried away the map, but nobody can answer for certain. How it disappeared from Jefferson's hands, he would have been very tenacious about keeping it, and then how it wound up in France. So that's a mystery yet to be solved.
And Thomas Jefferson's French ship make some great bouillabaisse or something? Why did Tooney inscribe the map to his chef?
Nobody knows the answer to that. That's the weirdest part of this. I've heard of Honoré Julien in my life, but only in the realm of cuisine. Not in the realm of Enlightenment cartography. So there's a mystery for you.
Why do you think Lewis and Clark did not recognize fully his contributions to their expedition? Were there just too much stuff out there? They couldn't see the forest for the trees, or was it something else?
Well, there's a lot going on. They had just had a court-martial, a very severe one, of a man named John Newman. The river was beginning to ice up. They weren't sure where they were going to winter. Lewis felt that they were behind. Lewis, I have to say, even though I portray him and love him, he was a little bit indifferent about native peoples. Clark was better with native peoples than Lewis. I think they took Tooney for granted, but nobody else did. And so that's one of the great things about this, is that Tooney now emerges with some people like Twisted Hair of the Nez Perce and Kabaway of the Clatsops, or even with Sacagawea as one of the most important native peoples who helped Lewis and Clark along.
And he dies in Washington, D.C. in 1806, and nobody knows where he's buried.
I've spent some time looking for this with a friend of mine named Steve Beckham, who knows how to do the graveyard registers and has done a lot of this sort of thing in his life. And we spent 2.5 days once going to every cemetery in the District of Columbia and nothing. So that's another mystery. And here's one of my hopes, Doug. This is, I think, maybe my greatest hope. I know that the Arikara are interested in finding the remains of Tooney. If that could be done, he deserves a native burial ceremony. He got a white man's burial ceremony, of course, if any. There might be, under NAGPRA, the repatriation of those remains to the Arikara people in North Dakota. There are any number of things, but I think it would be a tremendous thing if there were a ceremony of some sort, either in the District of Columbia or here or both, about this extraordinary man and to find the grave. I think it could be done if we really concentrated on it, and then to do the right kind of honors for the Arikara people.
I was heartened to read that Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter of condolence to the Arikara after Tooney died.
It's a great thing. You know, you can find it online. It's typical Jefferson. He loved native peoples, and he loved – and I don't mean this in the way it's going to sound, Doug, but Jefferson wrote to native peoples in a kind of Indian – what he thought was an appropriate Indian lingo. So he's always saying things like, we come from beyond the great stinking lake, and we're as numerous as the blades of grass, and all – you know, it's kind of weird today. It feels a little artificial and maybe even a little condescending, but he thought he was doing the right thing. You know, my heart is on the ground, or let us bury the hatchet, that sort of thing. And he wrote this famous letter. And then at the end, he says to Gravelines, and would you, when you're out there, would you teach them agriculture? Well, that's the funniest part of it all, because the Arikara had been practicing agriculture for 1,000 years. They were amongst the great farmers of the American continent. We know that the Mandan, the Hidatsa, and the Arikara were famous farmers. They were our first farmers. And so Jefferson is sort of, in his usual Enlightenment way, saying, well, take some seeds out and teach them agriculture, would you?
Well, in this very interesting element that you have in the quarterly, we proceeded on, the William Dunlap's meeting with Tooney.
Amazing.
It ends with this very interesting sentence. After a pretty long interview, we shook hands and parted much pleased with the novelty of the exhibition and the animation and intelligence of the old savage, referring to Tooney, who compared to the stupid Indian of the North is a civilized man. What does that tell us about
everyone who met him was really was taken by how intelligent he was, his linguistic capacities. He also was a master of native sign language. He made this long journey to Washington. He wrote this map. He was a tremendous man. I don't know why Lewis and Clark didn't see him quite in the same way that others did, but you saw in that passage you quoted there, Doug, some of the Eurocentrism and the racism, I suppose you'd have to say, of white people at the time. You know, if this is an extraordinary human being, he's different from other Indians in the minds of William Dunlap and maybe even in the minds of Lewis and Clark. We see things in a much more generous way now, much less culturally arrogant and self-centered. That's been one of the great revolutions in the way we see things, and frankly, we need to go a lot farther down that path here in the state of North Dakota.
Well, as we were reminded, when victors write history, they also draw maps, and that can affect the way we look at history.
Of course.
Clay Jenkinson is a Lewis and Clark scholar. He's the editor of the quarterly We Proceeded On. We've been talking about the current issue of that quarterly, which has a very important story in it. Thanks, Clay, for joining us today.
I'm thrilled. Thanks for doing this. This conversation could only have occurred on public radio. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. Coming up on Main Street, North Dakota Shakespeare is about to open its second season.
I am Elizabeth Medicine Crow.
My name is Jacob Dean Bearshield.
My name is Cecil B. Crawford. I am 5'8" Blackfeet. My Indian name is Oma Katayu Nitsitsi.
Hi, I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. Come tell your story when our mobile recording booth comes to town.
StoryCorps will be in Bismarck, June 28th through July 27th. You'll be able to make a reservation and schedule your interview starting June 14th.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Stephanie Murray and Amber Marissa Cook. They're involved with North Dakota Shakespeare. They join us from our microphone in Grand Forks. Good afternoon, Stephanie and Amber.
Hi, thank you so much for having us today.
Hello.
Stephanie, let's start with you. You're the founder, you're the producing artistic director. Give us a brief history of the North Dakota Shakespeare Company and its mission.
Sure. So North Dakota Shakespeare was formally founded in November of 2016, funded initially by a grant from the UND College of Arts and Sciences. I had a dream of starting a professional Shakespeare company here in North Dakota, and luckily they agreed that it was a good idea and fully funded us last year, which was really incredible. So we were able to bring professional artists from all over the country to Grand Forks for our first season, which was Romeo and Juliet. And you know, the dream was to keep it going, not just be a one-season wonder. And luckily, we were able to find funding from numerous sources this year. We have quite a few smaller grants that made all the funding possible this year. So we are back for a second season doing Twelfth Night. The mission of the organization is to provide professional theater to the community, regardless of economic status. So all of our productions are free of charge to anyone in the community who is interested in seeing professional Shakespeare in the park.
And the show this year is Twelfth Night, which plays June 12th through the 16th at 7 p.m. and June 17th at 2 p.m. at Town Square. That's in downtown Grand Forks near the Demers Bridge. Amber, how did you find your way to the North Dakota Shakespeare Company?
Well, actually, I've had the good fortune of working with Stephanie for several years at the Black Hills Playhouse in Custer, South Dakota. And it just so happened the stars aligned. I have been working freelancing all over the country, and I contacted Stephanie and I said, if you ever have an opening for a costume designer, I'd love to come out and work with you guys. And it worked out this year, so I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
Stephanie, when and how do you recruit the company for the season?
We do a national search starting around November each year. We hold a local audition here in Grand Forks. We also go to a unified audition at the American College Theater Festival Region 5. So the company is structured so we have a professional company and an apprentice company, and every apprentice company member has a professional company member that they shadow throughout the process. So most of the apprentices come from that American College Theater Festival audition and interview. And then the professionals are largely selected through a digital audition and interview process simply because of our location. We are a bit geographically challenged in terms of being located near a major theater community. But we post on playbill.com and broadwayworld.com, and we usually get upwards of 400 digital submissions. So we, you know, sift through all of the portfolios and resumes and audition videos, and then invite people to do Skype callbacks with us. This year, we also were able to go to New York City to do a few live callbacks. So the actresses playing Viola and Olivia for us, I got to audition live in New York City based on their initial audition submissions.
So you've got a company, and you have a costume designer, and you've got your husband as the company manager, and he's playing the role of Festi in the show. I played Mercutio last year in Romeo and Juliet. I do my research.
I appreciate that.
So Romeo and Juliet, bit of a tragedy. Twelfth Night, a comedy. Why did you choose the play?
We chose it because we thought, you know, after the tragedy of last season, the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet, the production was not a tragedy. we thought that it would be nice to balance it with something more comedic and something a bit more family friendly. Last year, we billed the production as PG-13, but we are rating 12th Night as PG and encouraging younger children to come out as well this season. And also, it's, you know, it's a romantic comedy. There's a little bit of everything. There's lots of jokes and physical bits, but there's also a love story.
Well, it is a story about cross-dressing heroines. I mean, you've got men playing women playing men. It's a Shakespearean thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Viola, you know, to make her way in this new land has to dress like a man to get employment. So, yeah, we have a love triangle and cases of mistaken identity and all kinds of mischief and mayhem.
And for folks who know their Shakespearean history, they know that young boys actually played women's roles on the stage at his time. Now, of course, you can cast actual women to play women.
Yes.
Amber, what is the design concept for the show? Is this period or contemporary?
It's definitely period, although which period remains to be seen. So the director, Carrie Colton, had this brilliant idea of, you know, the traveling troupe of actors who pop up on stage and pull all of their wares from a trunk, you know, to perform a show, which was really great for me because we've got a sort of mishmash of time periods that are all kind of literally held together by a theme of patchwork through it. The idea that things are being repaired on the fly and sort of patched together. So, you know, if any quilters come and see the show, I think they'll find it very aesthetically pleasing. But one of the conceits behind that also is that all of these characters are so intermingled and touch each other's lives, sometimes without even realizing it. And so there's sort of bits and pieces of each character on other characters' costumes. So it's a fun, whimsical, sort of vaguely carnival, vaguely circusy, really bright and colorful show.
Sounds like fun on an outdoor stage in the summer evening. Carrie Colton is the director, Stephanie, and she directed the show last year, too.
She did, yes. She is originally from Utah and got her undergraduate degree at Southern Utah University, which is affiliated with the Utah Shakespeare Festival. So she apprenticed there when she was younger and continued on to do several other Shakespeare festivals. But she and I actually met working in South Korea at a children's theater and got to be really good friends. And she's, you know, one of the directors that I find most creative and most inspiring. So when we first started this company, I invited her to come direct Romeo and Juliet, and it went very well. So she's back for a second season.
Well, 12th Night will take stage at the Town Square in downtown Grand Forks June 12th through the 16th at 7 in the evening and June 17th at 2 in the afternoon. Let's talk a bit about the challenges of outdoor performances, Stephanie.
Absolutely. Well, in North Dakota, one of the most interesting challenges is the daylight. And, you know, this time of year, we have very long days and it doesn't get dark till almost 10 p.m. And when Carrie was first coming to direct last year, she kept saying, and then there'll be a blackout. And then there'll be a blackout. And we said, no, there are no blackouts. And it she didn't believe us until she arrived that it truly would not get dark until 9:45, 10 o'clock. So that's a challenge. You know, how do you successfully transition from scene to scene and represent indoor and outdoor in different times of day with no lighting to assist you?
How do you do it?
We have kind of a creative concept. One of the ensemble members this year holds different props to help indicate whether they're indoors or outdoors. So, you know, for instance, she might be a painting when we're indoors, or might be a bush when we're outdoors. So she helps with some of the kind of visual cues to let us know where we are. And the actors are much more physical in their transitions than you might be in a production that has full stage lighting, because we don't have the luxury of blackout and casually walk off stage. The audience can see you until you are completely out of view.
Amber, when did you start working with Carrie on this? When did rehearsals start?
Well, rehearsals started only about 2 weeks ago, actually, though we started long-distance production meetings for this a couple of months ago. So we were talking sketches and research and that kind of thing. Back in March, we started kind of putting things together, and then it was kind of funny because shortly before we all got here, we basically all went out of the country for about a week and a half and were out of contact. So we designed the show and then fell out of contact, and then we all arrived here and picked it right back up again.
Well, this enterprise, costumes and, you know, people take money. You suggested, Stephanie, that you had some revenue streams. How is your enterprise funded?
It is almost completely grant funded. This year we have grants from University of North Dakota, the Myra Foundation, the Grand Forks Convention and Visitors Bureau, and the Community Foundation of Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, and Region. So we have four different grants. And then we also have several fundraising performances and projects throughout the year. We did a Shakespearean social back in November where people actually got to help us vote on our upcoming production. We presented scenes from three comedies, and then they got to submit a ballot saying which comedy they would like to see. We also just had a 5K this past Saturday that we called the Rude Run, and Shakespearean actors were placed along the route insulting the actors, or insulting the runners, rather. So that was a lot of fun. You know, it was a race, but some sort of negative reinforcement motivation along the way.
Well, we used it in our What's Happening segment last Thursday, so thanks for that, because it was fun to say, too.
Yeah.
So how did it go?
I think it went really well. We had just under 100 participants, which, you know, I had said initially, if we get 25 or so this year, I think we'll be pleased. But we were really blown away. We ran out of T-shirts. It was, you know, really kind of best case scenario in terms of race outcomes. I think everyone had a good time, and the actors had a blast insulting the runners.
Well, this is the second season. Will there be a third?
We hope so. It's, you know, all a little touch and go until we know whether or not the grant funding has come through. But the community support has been really wonderful so far, and the fact that we can say, you know, X number of people attended the show last year and we hope that the numbers will grow this season really shows that there is a desire for this to continue in the community and helps improve our chances of getting grants in the future.
Well, it's Twelfth Night, or What You Will. It's a comedy by William Shakespeare. It takes the stage in downtown Grand Forks June 12th through the 16th at 7, June 17th at 2 in the afternoon. Stephanie Murray is the founder and producing artistic director. Thanks for joining us, Stephanie.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And Amber Marissa Cook is the costume designer and the costume shop manager. Welcome to North Dakota, Amber.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota. Support is provided by Cable One High Speed Internet, designed to offer a streaming connection that allows customers to watch movies and videos without buffering or interruption. More information at 1-855-CABLE-1.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 5th, North Dakota Remembers World War I. June 5th in 1918 was the first anniversary of the Selective Service Draft Act,
Almost 6 million men across the nation between the ages of 21 and 31 had, during that time, registered for the draft. The draft was considered fairer than the Civil War draft in that it hit all aspects of society more equally. During the Civil War, a conscript could hire a substitute to take his place and thus avoid military service. During World War I, most of the exemptions favoring the rich had been eliminated, and men of draft age from well-to-do families were actually drafted in proportionally greater numbers than the children of the poor, since men from poorer families were needed at home to support dependents or to work in essential war industries and were therefore exempted. The 1917 Selective Service Act allowed for the conscription of 655,000 men to fill the ranks of the regular army and the National Guard. Plus, it provided for the drafting of an additional 1 million men to train for military service. North Dakota had been required to send almost 8,000 men, but since one-third of that number had already volunteered, that left slightly over 5,000 who were drafted and were now on their way to Fort Lewis, Washington. The second round of draft registrations began on this date in 1918 with the intention of including all men who had turned the age of 21 during the previous year. Cass County alone registered almost 300 men. The group was comprised of 293 American-born men, including one Negro, 18 friendly aliens, and 15 enemy aliens. This second draft registration brought one significant change regarding exemptions. Those engaged in farm and industrial occupations that supported the war had been allowed a Class 3 exemption, but that exemption was now gone, replaced by a policy called Go to Work or Go to War, in which anyone whose number hadn't been drawn could still be drafted if they weren't engaged in productive labor. It was hoped that this anti-slacker policy could make up for the workers lost to the draft. But with an unprecedented acreage of crops now in the ground, it was a major gamble. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Eight states hold midterm primaries Tuesday. The winners could help decide which party will control Congress. One state in particular is being watched closely for its unusually competitive races this time around, California.
Because if Democrats are going to capture enough seats to take back the House of Representatives, it will very likely come through California.
We'll have the latest on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, PBS's Great American Read is underway, with voters choosing America's favorite book. And on Wednesday, we'll visit with avid readers Greg Danz and Val Static. Danz owns Zanbro's, an independent variety and bookstore in Fargo, and Static owns Main Street Books in Minot. So we look forward to that. And also on Wednesday, we'll visit with Sue Balcom of the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.